Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
When I was growing up as a kid, I always wanted to be a host of a podcast series that discussed the social scientific aspects of religion. Given that this was way back in the 1970s when podcasts, iPods, and even the internet as we know it today had yet to be invented, that was an odd career choice, and I'm sure that my friends would have made fun of me if I ever made that career goal public. Instead of telling them my true desires, I told them that I wanted to be an astronomer, a physicist, or an astronaut. In reality, those were my ultimate professional goals. You know, ever since being a kid, I have been fascinated by astronomy and then later physics. Unfortunately, the drinking age was 18 where I was growing up, and my experience with high school calculus was, well, to put it mildly, indicating that a life in the natural sciences might not be for me. And so I became the next best thing, a political scientist who did eventually have to learn calculus. However, this spurred me on to that lifelong goal of becoming a podcast host. Mission accomplished. Now, despite this change in life's plans, I've always maintained a fascination with astronomy and physics and have consumed a great deal of the popular literature on the topic. The recent purported empirical discovery of the Higgs boson, also known as the God particle, piqued my attention and got me to thinking about doing a show on religion and physics. Now, the standard line from secularization theory has it that science and religion don't mix, and that continued scientific discoveries would make it harder to keep the faith, so to speak. Well, I want to examine that question today by talking to an honest-to-goodness physicist, Dr. Stephen Barr, who on July 10th of this year penned an article for the Templeton Foundation's Big Questions Online blog entitled, Does Quantum Physics Make It Easier to Believe in God? Dr. Barr is a professor of physics and director of the Department of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Delaware. Like all those noteworthy hard scientists who work in cool laboratories, Professor Barr has authored a bazillion articles on physics, including The Search for a Permanent Electric Dipole Moment and Fermion Masses in SO10 with a Single Adjoint Higgs Field. Additionally, he is credited with co-discovering the much-studied flipped SU5 scheme of unification, identifying the Barr-Z diagram as an important source of electric dipole moment for basic particles such as the electron and neutron in many theories, and proposing the so-called Nelson-Barr mechanism as a solution to the strong CP problem. I quote all of that from his Wikipedia biography since I could not have possibly been able to write something that complicated. And for our present purposes, I should note that Professor Barr writes frequently about the relation between religion and science for First Things, as well as many other publications. We'll link to a lot of those things on our website, so make sure you visit us and make sure that you like us on Facebook, because if you like us on Facebook, we will be sure to return the love. Steve, welcome to Research on Religion.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Hey, let me ask you about some of those articles that I just cited. And first off, you wrote this article called The Search for a Permanent Electric Dipole Moment. Now, the obvious question there is, did you find it? And if so, where was it?
Well, no one's found one yet.
so you're kind of like Bono from U2. And that song, I Still Haven't Found What I'm Looking For, is probably biographical about your search there.
Right. It's unlike the Higgs boson, it hasn't. Electric dipole moments have not been found.
Well, this is my advice, and granted, I am a social scientist, but I would say a good place to look for it is the last place that you look, because I always find things in the last place I look, and it's usually behind the laundry machine with all those missing socks. So, just in case you haven't there, and if you do find it there, give me a little name on that thing too, and it'll be okay.
Yep.
All right.
Actually, electric dipole moments, they're not so esoteric. What it says is that the particles that of which things are made are kind of a little bit lopsided.
No.
And that their electric charge, there's more electric charge on one side of the particle than on the other side. That's what that means. And some of the theories predict that they should be lopsided like that, but people have looked, and they're not. That's kind of a puzzle. There's a real theoretical puzzle there.
And that is cool, and that's what scientists like, right? We predict things, and then reality isn't quite like that, and then we scratch our heads and head back into the laboratory and such.
Right.
But if it's all about lopsidedness, again, I would say look behind my dryer, because every time I got something going in there, that thing is wobbling all over the place. So the other thing I have to ask you, too, and this was the other article I mentioned, and you've written a bunch of them, but this article called Fermion Masses in SO10 with a Single Adjoint Higgs Field. Now, I usually read a lot of the stuff that I have my guests or that my guests have written here on the show, but I have to admit I haven't read that. So I'm hoping, is that going to be coming out in a theatrical format at the movie Cineplex anytime soon?
No, maybe on pay-per-view.
Okay. I will subscribe to that. That would be kind of cool. You know, that's great title. Fermion Masses in SO10. Okay. One other thing, too, just to kind of, because I have to admit, I'm very giddy about interviewing a physicist because of my love for this stuff, and I usually only talk to sociologists and political scientists. It's really cool to have stuff in physics named after you. Was that kind of a big thrill the first time that you had something named after you and you saw it in print?
Not such a thrill, because the things that are named after me, and there's a couple of things like the Bar-Z diagram, they're purely theoretical things that haven't been found in experimentally yet. They're hypothetical things. The real thing is when you have something that's known to be an aspect of the real world named after you. So these are still just speculative ideas.
I don't know. That's still pretty cool. I don't get anything named after me, so... Very cool. All right, let's get a little bit serious now. You penned a very fascinating piece in the Big Questions Online blog, which, again, we'll link to, asking whether or not quantum physics makes it easier to believe in God. And now, before we get to that answer, which I found to be a little bit surprising, was right there in the first line of the paper, I was hoping if you could clear up a few things about what is going on with this so-called God particle, also known as the Higgs boson. It was discovered empirically, I guess, this past summer. What is this God particle thing, and how did it get the name, the God particle?
I'm glad you asked me that. This is really annoys me, and I think many physicists are annoyed by this. The Higgs boson is a particle. It's one of about 18 particles that exist in our present theory of physics. The way it got in, physicists do not call it the God particle, never have.
Hmm.
The way that word arose, it was a particularly inane piece of media hype that was cooked up by some publishers and then has been perpetuated by journalists. And the way it happened, apparently, is that a very well-known physicist named Leon Lederman wrote a book in which he wanted to call, I think the title of his book, he wanted to be the goddamn particle.
Mm.
Because the Higgs particle is very elusive. People have been trying to find it, you know, experimentally for a long, long time and have been coming up empty. And so they're frustrated, because now it looks like they have found it. But for a long time, they were frustrated by their inability to find this thing. And so he wanted to call it the goddamn particle.
Mm.
But the publisher apparently said it'll sell more books if you call it the God particle.
Yeah, you wouldn't have to deal with FCC regulations either.
God particle. That sounds really important. So that's how it got started. And then, of course, journalists have kept it up. It is never, in my 40 years in physics, I've never heard a physicist call it the God particle. It's just not called that. And the thing is, it's not that important a particle in a sense. I mean, as I said, in the standard theory you have, there are 18 types of particles. And the Higgs particle is just one of those 18. And the other ones include, for example, the electron. You know, everyone's heard of electrons.
Yep, heard that one.
There are things called photons. Those are particles of light. And all of them are important in one way or another. I mean, there's other bosons besides the Higgs boson. There's five other types of bosons. And each one of those five types is responsible for one of the forces of nature.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the particles we know of are important in one way or another. This is just one of a whole gang of particles. There's nothing sort of cosmic importance about it. It's certainly nothing of theological or philosophical importance about it. It's just a particle.
And that's really interesting, because when this was discovered or seen in the particle smasher that they have out there in Switzerland this summer, a lot of my colleagues would come up to me and say, see, you know what, they found the God particle. And there was this assumption that it was the initial particle or the initial thing that starts off the Big Bang or the whole universe. And, you know, they would point to this and say, see, religion is pretty much irrelevant now because we have seen that life comes from material particles and such. And
right. Well, let me say a few things about that. First of all, it kind of reminds me of what, you know, back in the 60s or maybe it was even the 50s when the first cosmonauts went into outer space, Nikita Khrushchev announced that the cosmonauts had not seen God out there in space, and that this kind of proved that atheism was correct.
Mm-hmm.
And any intelligent person recognizes that's a very primitive kind of, you know, kind of moronic thing to say.
Yeah, that goes back. Yeah, it goes back to the old Sherlock Holmes saying: is that the absence of evidence is not evidence of absence.
It's just God is not. Did anyone think God is floating around in space like some sort of, you know, piece of debris? I mean, God is not a physical object. He is not a part of the universe. He is the mind that conceived of the universe, that thought it up. He's not just a part of the universe. And so you're not going to see God in a telescope or in a microscope, nor can anything you see in a microscope or a telescope take the place of God. A little bit of matter, whether it's a particle or a star or anything else, is not going to be able to play the role that God plays according to traditional, you know, Judeo-Christian religion, which is as the mind that conceived of the whole universe. So it's kind of if your colleagues really are coming up and saying that to you, I think these people should be administered an IQ test. This is really a very dumb thing for them to say. I should also say they should learn not to take what they read in both the popular media and in the scientific popular media with a huge grain of salt. There's this enormous amount of hype there.
Yeah.
The Higgs has very little to do, the Higgs boson, or the Higgs particle, has very little to do with how the universe began.
Mm-hmm.
It's really nothing much to do with that. I mean, there's a lot of deep questions concerning how the universe started off. What happened at the time of the Big Bang, or what happened in the earliest moments of the universe. The Higgs boson has very little to do with that at all. But journalists, in order to make things in my field, particle physics, sound important to arouse the interest of their reader, everything in my field has to be somehow linked to the beginning of the universe and how it all started and this kind of thing, just to sell,
mm-hmm.
to sell copies. And so it's totally irrelevant to how the universe began.
Yeah, no, I can see that. You want to get yourself in the newspaper, and universities love that when you get into the news, and or even for physicists, probably getting on Star Trek is probably like the gold standard of
right.
of something. But it is interesting that you talk about my colleagues and how my colleagues react to this too, because I mean there's somewhat of an indictment of intellectuals in this as well, is because, you know, for me, I'm a political scientist. I hang around with sociologists. We are all pretty smart people. We've got PhDs and lots of other fancy initials behind our names. And when we read something in the news, we automatically make this assumption that, well, the news must be correct. And I absorb all this. And since I'm smart and studying religion and politics, I must be very smart in understanding physics. And we go around championing this stuff all over the time. It kind of really reminds me of the limits that us intellectual elite, the intelligentsia, really have.
Right. Yeah, in fact, as a political scientist and somebody in the social sciences, you will understand perhaps better than most people the forces at work that make people hype these things. And
yeah.
It's not just in the media. So scientists will, in the abstracts of their papers that they publish, they're always trying to attract the attention of other researchers. And so in the abstracts of their papers, they try to pump up what they're doing and make it seem more important. And in their proposals for grants from the government, in their grant proposals, they're always sort of hyping what they're doing. But it's even worse in the popular press. So 90% of what you read about as far as things that describing the importance of some scientific achievement, 90% of that is nonsense. It's just way over the top. One thing I'd like to say about the beginning of the universe, even let's suppose that the Higgs did have something to do important with shedding light on how the universe started off. That still doesn't touch the question of whether God exists. Mm-hmm. And I think this is a fundamental distinction that people have to get into their minds. There are two distinct questions. One is, what happened at the beginning of the universe? And the second question is, why is there a universe?
Yeah.
And maybe the distinction can be, it's the difference between the beginning and the origin. So let me make an analogy. Take a novel. If you ask what happens at the beginning of the novel, that's one question. That's like, what are the first sentences? What are the first words of the novel? That's one question. The other question is, why is there a novel? Because somebody wrote it. In other words, behind the novel stands some creative mind that conceived of the novel. That's the question of the creator. What happens at the beginning of the first chapter or the first words or the first paragraph of the novel is not the same as the question of why is there a novel at all. And so I personally believe that we will someday, or I don't, I think there's a good chance that we will someday have a very good theoretical understanding of the events that happened at the beginning of the universe and why they happened in the particular way that they did. But that won't still, that doesn't touch the question of why is there a universe at all. And I think what happened at the time of the Big Bang may have been perfectly natural in the sense that it obeyed the laws of physics in the same way as what happens at the beginning of a novel obeys the laws of grammar, just like the rest of the novel. But none of that touches the question of why there is a novel or why there's a universe. So that's, I think, the bigger mistake your colleagues are making, is that they think that some scientific description of the events at the beginning somehow replace God. They clearly don't.
Yeah, this gets to one of these philosophical issues that I always wrangle with, and it's probably one of the reasons why I, within astronomy, I really love the whole topic of cosmology, because it gets, and you put it very well, you know, talking about the beginning and the origins, because it seems to me that we have this assumption that existence as it is the default option in the universe. But sometimes I think, well, why would that be the case? Wouldn't nothingness, emptiness be a default option as well?
Right. And that's the old question. I don't know if it went back to Leibniz or some other great philosopher. I think it may have been Leibniz, who asked, why is there something rather than nothing? Why is there anything at all?
Mm-hmm.
When we say the default option, which is a good way of putting it, is not empty space. Space is something. You know, even according to modern physics, space is a physical thing.
Mm-hmm.
Space-time is a physical thing, just as physical as a rock or a tree or anything else. So the default option is not even empty space. No space, no time, no matter, no nothing, no laws of physics, just blank non-existence. The fact that there's anything, that there's anything at all in existence, is a profound mystery. It's a very, it should surprise people
mm-hmm.
that there is something. And that's the question, again, of a creator.
Yeah.
He's the answer, or God is the answer to the question of why is there something?
Well, one of the things that, when we talk about this default option, that there's always been stuff or things, you bring up in a way in your article, Does Quantum Physics Make It Easier to Believe in God? You talk about this philosophy of materialism, or sometimes referred to as physicalism. Could you explain that a little bit? Because I think this is really going to help us understand your argument later on when you start to talk about mind. So what is this philosophy of materialism?
Well, it's a philosophy that is gaining a lot of ground in the modern world, and I think it's the chief competitor, really, of to belief in God. I think when you press, if you really think deeply about things, you find that there's sort of really two options, materialism or theism. Materialism is the view that the ultimate reality is matter. And in its modern form, you say matter governed by the laws of physics, that the laws of physics are the whole, that's it. That's everything. So everything in the world, everything that happens can be explained as a consequence of the laws of physics and chance. And that would include the human mind, for example, which the materialists would say is just a material system called the brain, in operation. It's just all the particles in our brains moving around in space and time according to the laws of physics, and that's it. That's all that's going on when you're talking about the human mind. So that's materialism. It's a severely reductionist view of the world. There's no place for anything but matter in motion.
And before we get to your discussion of mind that you have in this article, I want to talk about quantum physics. So that's the next step in here, because, again, a lot of my listeners here are not theoretical physicists. Quantum physics is something that we do hear in the news, we hear on Star Trek, and it's something that we oftentimes get scared about. So what is quantum physics or quantum mechanics? What is that stuff that you do?
Okay. Well, it's first of all, it's not a particular theory of this kind of thing or that kind of thing. It's an overarching framework for all of physics. All of physics is, as it were, expressed in the language of quantum mechanics. What happened when older physics, it was so-called classical physics, was replaced by quantum physics back in the 1920s. In some sense, physics changed its whole language, if you will. So quantum physics applies to everything. Everything you can think of is governed by the principles, the fundamental principles of quantum physics. Everything in the physical world is governed by these principles. As to what explaining it, that would be very difficult. It's a very alien to our way. Our ordinary way of thinking about the world corresponds to the older classical physics. All our physical intuition about the way things work, based on our everyday experience, is very classical.
It's like Newtonian physics, right?
Yeah,
the stuff we learned in high school.
Okay. Right, and quantum physics is very, very hard to wrap your mind around. It really, you have to work with it. You have to do quantum physics for several years before you begin to develop a sort of feeling for it and a kind of begin to see things in that way. One of the big differences between quantum physics and classical physics, which is philosophically very significant. In classical physics, you had just two things. You had some system, some physical system, and you had equations that governed that system. And that's all there was. And so in classical physics lent itself to a kind of materialist view of the world, because in the final analysis, you should think of the whole world as just a system, and then there would be some equations governing it, and that's all there is. And so everything would unfold in classical physics, would unfold in this just following the rules. The whole world would be just like a machine following these rules blindly. And that's the classical picture. There was no room for anything but matter, because the system, everything is just a system, and by definition, this system is composed of matter. In quantum mechanics, it's a little more subtle. You have really three elements in quantum mechanics. You always have a system. Then you have an observer who is making measurements of the system or studying the system. And then you have equations. So you have a system, an observer, and equations. And so what do the equations tell you? Well, in classical physics, the equations told you exactly what the system was going to do. Okay? In quantum mechanics, they don't do that. The equations tell you not what the system is doing. They tell you what the observer is likely to see if he makes a measurement of the system. It's a little bit more subtle. And so you see right away in the whole picture that quantum mechanics paints of the world, you have an additional element in there, which is an observer making measurements, okay? And that has profound philosophical implications.
Does this get at that whole Schrodinger's cat paradox?
It does.
Okay.
And maybe we could put that off for a few minutes.
Okay.
I think that there are two crucial things. One is the crucial thing is that quantum mechanics involves this observer, a system and an observer. And the second thing is that it doesn't tell you exactly what's going to happen. It tells you the probabilities that the observer is going to see this or that.
Right.
The fact that it only tells you probabilities is very significant because it tells you that the future is to some extent undetermined. In classical physics, the future is all, given the way the world is now, there's only one way everything can turn out in the future. In quantum mechanics, that's not true. In quantum mechanics, even if you had a complete and exact description of what the physical world is doing now, there are many things that the world can be doing in the future. And the laws of physics only say this outcome is this probability, this outcome has that probability. It doesn't uniquely specify what's going to happen. And many people have pointed out that this kind of opens the possibility of that there's free will. In the old classical world, it's hard to see how we could have free will since the future is already fixed based on what's happening now, okay? So that's one philosophical implication, possibly. But the other thing is the fact that observers seem to play a role in quantum mechanics is profound implications also and has caused lots and lots of debate and disagreement over the last, 80 years or so, is how much importance do we attach to this fact that observers play a role in quantum mechanics.
Yeah.
But as you say, it has something to do with Schrodinger's cat, because some people don't like this, because they say, if quantum mechanics no longer talks about, says that observers actually cause things to happen by observing them. When I look at the moon, I'm somehow causing the moon to exist by looking at it.
Yeah, that sounds really weird.
Yeah, and that's not what quantum mechanics says, but it can lead in that direction. It can lead in that direction, and that's why many people are uncomfortable with it.
Mm-hmm.
Some people think it puts too much emphasis on our observations of the world.
Mm-hmm. Describe what the Schrodinger's cat paradox is. As I understand it, you put there's a cat in a box, and you don't know if he coughed up a hairball on your brand new carpet until you open up the box, and it really hasn't coughed up a hairball until you've actually opened up that
right.
box.
Okay, the traditional idea was that that there are these probabilities that quantum mechanics talks about, and then there are the probabilities that, as I said, the observer is going to see this or that. So Schrodinger didn't like this. Schrodinger is one of the founders of quantum mechanics, and he thought this whole business of probabilities and uncertainty and all this kind of thing was for the birds, and he wanted to cook up an example to show how absurd it was.
Ah.
So we invented this thing, which is now called the Schrodinger cat paradox. And so the idea was this. You have a big box, and you inside the box you have a cat, and you have a little vial of cyanide or something, and then you have a radioactive nucleus, which has, quantum mechanics says, has a 50% chance of radioactively decaying and making a click in the Geiger counter, and a 50% chance of not decaying. And you set up a gizmo with a Geiger counter, and if the radioactive nucleus decays, it makes the Geiger counter click. That click then sends electrical signals to something that breaks the vial of poison, and the cat is killed. And if the thing doesn't radioactively decay, then the cat doesn't get killed. Now, according to quantum mechanics, as I said, the laws of quantum mechanics don't tell you what happens. They tell you the different things that might happen and the relative probabilities. And so the laws of quantum mechanics don't tell you. If you wait, suppose you wait, you're sitting around waiting, and then you calculate with the laws of quantum mechanics, and it says, there's a 50% chance that that radioactive nucleus decayed and the cat is dead, and there's a 50% chance that it didn't and the cat is alive. And that's what quantum mechanics tells you. That's all it tells you. Well, some people looked at that and said, but then, of course, if you open the box and look, you're either going to see a dead cat or a live cat. Now, there's one way of interpreting quantum mechanics, which is controversial, which says the cat, the laws of physics tell you what's actually going on, and because they tell you that the cat's 50% chance of being alive and 50% chance of being dead, that's what's actually going on. So the cat's in a kind of limbo.
Mm-hmm.
It's really, it's kind of like half dead and half alive. Okay?
Yeah.
It's kind of like these parallel universes coexisting with each other. And then you open the box, and bingo, the cat's either alive or the cat's dead. And so then it makes it look like, some people think what that looks like, is the cat wasn't really alive or dead until you looked at it.
Mm-hmm.
Because the laws of physics didn't tell you whether it was alive or dead. The only thing that kind of sort of forced it to be alive or dead was your act of opening the box and looking. And so Schrodinger thought this was kind of crazy. You know, he said, by God, he didn't say it in these words, but by jingo, even before I look, even before I open the box, the cat's either alive or it's dead. It's one or the other. It's got to be one or the other. But that's the big mystery of quantum mechanics. The laws of physics never describe it as being one or the other. It always just describes probabilities. And this is actually one of the deep conundrums of quantum mechanics, is that the laws of physics somehow don't describe the world as it is. They just describe possibilities and probabilities. And that's why people have been sort of being tied into philosophical knots for the last 80 years.
Yeah, I can completely understand that. And when you mention it takes, you know, several years just to even become comfortable with the notion of quantum physics, I hear you with that now, because I still wrestle with those things. And it is interesting that you brought this issue, and you mentioned this yourself, and I was going to ask about this, the issues of free will and determinism, or predeterminism, I should say. And how does those philosophical wranglings that have been going on for almost a century now related to all of this, has that discussion come up amongst physicists about predetermination and free will?
Well, not so much among physicists, because physicists tend to be, you know, stick to their knitting. You know, they tend to work on physics and leave the philosophy to other people. They're aware of these questions, I think. The more intellectual ones are aware of these questions, but it's mostly philosophers of mind and people like that that worry about these things. The party line now among people who don't believe in free will is that, yes, quantum mechanics doesn't uniquely determine what's going to happen in the future, but that's kind of irrelevant as far as human decision-making goes, because they would say the human brain acts very much like a classical system rather than a quantum mechanical system, because the human brain is very large and it's at a very high temperature, so to speak. And quantum mechanical indeterminacy really comes into play mostly when you're talking about very tiny systems like subatomic particles. So you're talking, you know, when you throw a baseball, you know, if you know how fast the baseball was going when it left the pitcher's hand, you can calculate, you know, and you know how the wind was blowing and everything, you can calculate where it's going to go over the plate. I mean, quantum indeterminacy makes no difference in everyday life, you know. You can calculate what's going to happen. You can shoot a rocket and you know where it's going to land. It's usually only when you're talking about subatomic particles that you have to worry about the fact that you can't calculate what's going to happen because of quantum indeterminacy. And so the standard line people say is, well, yeah, okay, there's quantum indeterminacy, but when you're talking about something as macroscopic like the human brain, that really doesn't matter, and therefore, in practice, the future is really determined. What you're going to think in 5 minutes is pretty much determined by what you're thinking now and what's going on now. That's a very common view among philosophers. I don't buy it.
Mm-hmm. There is this interesting tangent here. I'm going to move us a little bit away from physics, but to talking about the intellectual world and my field of political science and economics, is this whole debate between classical physics and quantum physics really resonates a lot in what I see in my own profession, is that a lot of people figure, you know, the social world is just like the classical Newtonian physics, and there's an equation, and all we have to do is just get it all the right information, plug it into equation, and boom, we're going to figure out where we're going. And we could possibly manipulate all those variables too. And it becomes very predetermined and also very enticing to actually manipulate these things. Whereas quantum mechanics say, no, well, it's a little bit more iffy and probabilistic than that. And for me, it resonates with one of my favorite economists, Friedrich Hayek, who said, well, it's really difficult to know all the things in our social life because they're always constantly changing. And wow, you just never know. It's very probabilistic.
Right. Well, yeah. You know, even in classical physics, nobody ever said that you could actually in practice predict the future because the world is so complicated. That is, in the classical time, you know, when people thought the world was governed by classical physics, they would say if you had a super intellect, you know, some super being who knew where every particle in the universe was and how fast it's moving and so on, that super intellect could, in principle, in theory, could calculate everything that's going to happen in the future. But of course, we poor humans, we don't know everything that's going on in the world. And we don't have the ability to calculate things that complicated. So even in the classical physics, in practice, you can't calculate, you can't figure out what's going to happen in the future. The world's just too darn complicated. Quantum mechanics says something even more shocking. It says even if you knew, even if you were, you know, some angelic being with a, you know, super intellect, and you knew everything that was going on in the world in exact detail, that still would not determine what was going to happen in the future. The universe is more like a game of chess. In a given position in a game of chess, there's a lot of different moves that can be made. There's a lot of different ways the game could evolve from a given position. And that's the same, the physical world is like that. Mm-hmm. From the position, so to speak, that we're in now, the world can take many different paths. There's not just one.
That's interesting. You physicists are too humble in what you say you can predict. I mean, there's many of us social scientists who do think we know it all and can predict the future. So I don't know. That's kind of scares me in many ways, and they oftentimes end up making policy for us. But, you know.
It's a kind of hubris. But even in physics, you can only predict. That's why you build laboratories, because you build a laboratory so you can create a very simple situation where you can make a prediction.
And control all the variables.
Control everything and make a prediction. As far as predicting things in this messy world of real life, no, you can't do that.
Okay, so we got a good sense of what quantum physics is. And here's the payoff question that relates back to the title of the article that you wrote on Big Questions Online, which is, does quantum physics make it easier to believe in God? And your answer is no.
Right.
And I thought it was going to be yes when I read it. I said, oh, yeah, you know, we got the proof. But you say no. And you also connect us to this concept that we've been moving around the edges a little bit here called the mind. Fill us in here.
Well, first of all, here's another example. You know, the way I said the God particle was a term invented by publishers.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'd written some articles on quantum mechanics and what it might have to say about the mind and whether the mind is just reducible to matter. And the people at Templeton picked up on that and asked me if I'd write an article about the philosophical implications of quantum mechanics. And it was they who suggested the title, Does It Make It Easier to Believe in God? And you see, they threw in the word God.
Mm-hmm.
Just the way the publishers made Leon Lederman call the Higgs particle the God particle. Now, I said, so, you know, that's what they wanted me to talk about, and they're the ones that asked me to write the article, and that's the title they gave me to write about. So I said, no, it doesn't make it easier to believe in God. But it does make it, it does make it harder to be a materialist. And since materialism is kind of the chief alternative in today's world to believe in God, most intellectuals, certainly most physicists, most philosophers, who reject a belief in God are material. They do it because they say that the only reality is the physical world. So there's no soul, there's no spiritual soul, there's no God, there's no angels. It's just the physical stuff that we can touch and taste and see. That's it. That's reality. And so I said quantum mechanics actually undermines materialism. And in a sense, therefore, indirectly, it makes it easier to believe in God because most people who are atheists are materialists. And, now, how does it undermine materialism? It's a very complicated, and I'll just give you a very thumbnail sketch. Remember I said quantum mechanics says there's systems, and then there's observers, and then there are laws governing the system. What has been argued since the time, since the 1930s, the great mathematician John von Neumann pointed out, that if you try in quantum mechanics to describe by the mathematics of quantum, by the laws of physics, absolutely everything, not only the physical system, but the so-called observer, you run into serious problems of consistency. You can't describe, you cannot put the observer on the same level as the physical system that he is making measurements of. If you try to think of the observer as just another physical, as just a part of the physical system, and then describe the observer using the mathematics of quantum mechanics, you run into inconsistencies. And that is profound, has profound implications, according to a number of famous physicists. It means that that there's something about observers like us that's not reducible to physics. And if you say there's something about us that's not reducible to physics, then you've immediately undercut materialism. And I'll give you two quotes that I used in the article. One was from Eugene Wigner, one of the great physicists of the 20th century, a Nobel Prize winner. And he's actually very famous because he wrote a number of essays on quantum mechanics and its implications. And he said, while many views, philosophical views, might be consistent with quantum mechanics, materialism is not. So he said outright, materialism is not consistent with quantum mechanics. Another great physicist of the 20th century named Sir Rudolf Peierls said, the idea that you can describe a human being, everything about a human being, including his knowledge and his consciousness, by physics, is untenable. There's still something missing. So he said outright, explicitly, the idea that you can just completely describe a human being in physical terms, including that person's mind, his thoughts, his consciousness, his knowledge, is not a tenable idea. He said this on the basis of quantum mechanics. So that's the thing. It's because of this that quantum mechanics has this kind of twofold view of reality, the system on the one hand and the observer on the other, that materialism has a very hard time being reconciled with quantum mechanics. There seem to be two kinds of reality, physical reality and mental reality, if you will. The observer has a mind, and because the observer has a mind, that's why the observer, you can't just lump him in with the system that he's making measurements of.
And so that's where we kind of get to this whole issue of mind, and you talk a little bit about the ultimate mind.
Right. Well, that was sort of thrown at the end of the article. Once you can accept that minds are something over and above, something different from matter, that there's more to a mind than just atoms in motion, you know, there's more to mind than that, that mind is a reality in its own right. Yes, there's such a thing as physical. There are physical things. They're real. Rocks and trees and Higgs bosons and electrons are real. But there's another kind of reality, which is mind, which is not the same kind of thing. And once you can accept that, and I think most ordinary people, most sane people, I should say, most ordinary people recognize that there's something different about thoughts, about ideas, that they live in a different realm. Once you accept that, that thoughts and ideas are in a different realm, are also real, then it's much easier to believe in God, because God, in the traditional view, is a mind. He's an infinite mind. And once you've accepted the reality of our own minds, it makes it a little easier to believe in the reality of greater minds, of higher minds than ours. That's why I think indirectly quantum mechanics can support a belief in God, but only indirectly, by sort of debunking or helping to debunk this very crude idea that everything is reducible to physics, to matter.
You make an interesting and subtle point here, and I want to bring this back to the issue of religion and science, and that subtle point is, does quantum mechanics or quantum physics make it easier to believe in God? You say no. It makes it harder to be a materialist, which then opens up the door to believing in God. Is it still just a matter of faith whether we believe in God, or can science actually play a part in this?
Well, it plays a part in a certain way. I think the traditional, if you go back and you look at the arguments that, say, early Christians and Jews made 2,000 years ago, more than 2,000 years ago, for the existence of God, one of the big arguments that they made was that the existence of a lawful and orderly universe points to a lawgiver. And that's a kind of a common sense idea. If there's a law, there's a lawgiver. And so they looked around and they said, look, we live in a universe that's very harmonious, beautiful, orderly, and lawful. And therefore, there had to be a lawgiver behind it. And if you don't mind, there's one of my favorite quotes I'd like to give. It's from an early Christian writer from the second century. And he was arguing against pagans. He was trying to prove to pagans or argue to pagans that God exists. And he said this. He said, if upon entering some home, you saw that everything there was well tended, neat, and decorative, you would imagine that some master was in charge of those good things and was more, you know, and was more beautiful than those good things. More. So too, in the home of this world, when you see providence, order, and law in the heavens and on earth, know that there is a Lord and author of the universe, more beautiful than the stars and the various parts of the world. I mean, so he pointed to the beauty, order, and lawfulness in the world as evidence of some lawgiver, some author who had imposed that order on the world. And I think this is where modern science, this has been the classic argument. This has been one of the main reasons for believing in God, is that the world is not just a chaos.
Mm-hmm.
It's lawful. It's an orderly place. And why is that? Now, the thing that science has done, modern science has done, is it has made us realize, much more than people 2,000 years ago possibly could have realized, how fantastically orderly the world is. The order of the world, the lawfulness of the world, runs far deeper than anyone imagined. We now see that everything that's happening around us is governed by mathematical laws of amazing sophistication and subtlety. You can't even begin to understand the laws of physics as particle physicists and understand them, for example, without spending years and years learning all sorts of sophisticated mathematics. So these laws that are governing the world are not some kind of trivial, it ain't beanbag, okay? These are not some sort of trivial rules like tic-tac-toe. The laws that are governing the universe are immensely sophisticated ideas. They're immensely sophisticated mathematical ideas underlying the physical world. And so when you look at that, you say, my God, the world, the architecture of the universe is based on these incredibly deep mathematical ideas. Doesn't that suggest that there is indeed a deep mind at work here? You know, it's the old argument. If there's a law, there's a lawgiver. If there are deep ideas governing the world, there should be a deep mind behind those ideas. And that's why I think modern science, it's baffling. Modern science ought to, if people would sort of slap themselves in the face and wake up and realize what they're looking at, modern physics ought to make every particle physicist in the world ought to get down on his knees.
Mm-hmm.
But for some reason, a lot of them, I don't know, they're sleepwalking or something. I don't think they recognize what
they're doing. Yeah. That is interesting, because as we mentioned before, you know, it comes down to questioning some of your fundamental basic assumptions about, you know, why is somethingness the default option rather than nothingness, and we really have to puzzle that out. But there's that other fundamental assumption is, well, why is order the natural realm of things, not disorder? One would actually think disorder would be the natural realm of things.
That's right. Why is everything so orderly? I mean, it's, you know, if you see people playing chess and you don't know what they're doing, you might say they're just moving pieces back and forth in some sort of random way. And then when you begin to understand that they're playing a game with very, you know, with very precise mathematical rules, well, then you realize somebody obviously decided upon those rules, you know, right? I mean, somebody invented chess. Somebody invented that system of rules. And as I said, the laws of physics, I think a lot of people don't understand. And it's kind of sad because it's not something that is easily accessible to 99.99% of people in the world because they haven't studied physics at a deep level, right? And so there's only relatively small number of people who are in a position to see this, but they'll tell you, the people who are in particle physics will tell you, even the atheists among them will tell you, that the laws of physics are incredibly beautiful and sophisticated mathematics. They make no bones about that. I mean, in fact, it's in the last 100 years, many physicists have pointed out that increasingly, when theorists are trying to figure out what the deepest laws of physics are, one of the main guiding principles is that it should be beautiful mathematics. That's become a sort of a guiding light in searching for fundamental theories. It should be beautiful mathematics. Why? Why is the world based on beautiful and sophisticated mathematics? As everybody agrees that it is. And I don't think there's any answer to that, except to say that there's a divine artist at work who has a very deep grasp of mathematics.
Well, in the remaining time here, I want to step back a little bit from that weird world of quantum physics and what this says about religion, and take it a little bit more to a personal level, if you don't mind, and talk about religion and science and how you traverse that divide in academia. As you mentioned, a lot of particle physicists and quantum mechanics folks, they're amazed by this beauty, and some of them remain atheists, and you know, other times people are firm believers, are very devout religious believers. And this surprises a lot of secularization theorists, because they figure, probably based on that assumption of materialism, that hey, once you figure out where all the particle goes, you just kind of toss the concept of God. Let me ask you about your upbringing. Were you raised in a religious household?
Right. I was raised a Catholic. I'm still a Catholic. And my mother was a cradle Catholic. My father was raised in an atheist household, and he didn't come to faith until he was not baptized until he was 79 years old.
Hmm.
So I actually had a kind of a mixed upbringing in a sense. That is, I was raised a Catholic, and my family was religious. But we all knew that my father was this had more skeptical views for most of his life, and so that's perhaps one reason why I'm able to see the world not only through the eyes of faith, but I also, I think, can see the world through the eyes of skepticism.
Yeah.
And then I moved in. I've always been puzzled that people think there's a war between science and religion. That's historically false.
Right.
That has been debunked by historians of science.
Yeah, one should mention, too, that since you mentioned that you were raised Catholic, is that the guy who came up with the idea of the Big Bang was a Catholic priest, George Lemaitre.
He was a physicist and a Catholic priest, and he's one of probably the chief architect of the Big Bang theory.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's just not true that there's been a war between science and religion. And historically, that's not true. I mean, all the great scientists all the great people who founded modern science, from Copernicus and Galileo and Kepler and Newton and Boyle and so on, were devout religious believers. In fact, most of the great scientists for two or 300 years from the beginning of modern science were religious. It's only in sort of recent, maybe 100 years, 150 years, that you find more atheism among scientists. And I think that has more sociological reasons than anything else.
It is interesting. I'm just speaking as a sociologist here. There have been surveys conducted of the beliefs of faculty members at universities all over the place. And they do find that people who are in the what they call the hard sciences or the natural sciences, like physics, like astronomy, like the biological sciences, tend to believe or tend to be believers more so than those in the social sciences, namely anthropology. I think anthropology comes down at the bottom of the heap because everything is socially constructed or something.
Right. I think it's not. So I think there's sociological reasons more than anything else.
Yeah.
I mean, for example, journalists are very few journalists are religious. That's not because they discover something in their journalistic work that shows them there's no God. It's there are sociological factors at work. I would say that in my environment, most scientists, you know, that I've met are either atheists, agnostics, or simply indifferent to the whole question.
Okay.
But there are quite a few. What people should not get the idea that the scientific world is all made up of atheists. It isn't. There are quite a lot of religious believers among scientists, including among top scientists. So it just like any other profession, there's a whole spectrum of beliefs. And I have not found in my own life, I mean, my colleagues respect me as a scientist, and many of them know that I'm religious, and I don't think they think any less of me as a physicist because of that. That's one of the, you know, that's one reason I get very angry at people like Dawkins. One of the glories of science is that it doesn't matter who you are. You could be from any part of the world, from any social and economic class. You could have any political views, any religious views, philosophical views, and you all sit down and you're doing the same physics, and it's a wonderful sort of, it's a wonderful place where it doesn't matter what you're, but the trouble is people like Dawkins and some of those sort of fanatics, like him, these fanatical atheists, are trying to make it, they're trying to make it that to be scientific is to be an atheist. And that's a terrible, if that ever came to be the case, it would be terrible for science. You know, if only certain types of people were allowed to do science or allowed to claim to be scientists.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a terrible, terrible, narrow-minded view of things. It would be like saying only conservatives or only Buddhists or only, you know, socialists were allowed to be scientists or something. I mean, what a crazy world that would be.
Mm-hmm.
But as I say, it's not like that. It's not like that. I think my science colleagues are a little more tolerant than that.
Well, that is definitely good to hear. And I, you know, your story is actually rather heartening to hear that, yes, you're religious and you're very outspoken about it. You write about this in the, you know, popular press, like the Templeton Foundation's blog and on First Things and a few other places like that. And you don't seem to be suffering a great deal of blowback there.
I would say this. I would warn young people, however.
That's my question. What's some advice?
I would warn you, if you are in the going into science, especially in the academic world, and this may be true not only in science, it could be true in English departments or history or some other. If you are religious, I would keep that a little bit close to the vest. I wouldn't be too outspoken about it until you have tenure. Because there could be somebody who would look askance at you and could harm you in your career. It hasn't happened to me, but it could happen, and so I would say, wait till you're well established before you start shooting off your mouth about these things. One other thing I would say, I never experienced growing up in my own mind any tension between science and religion. To me, they're both attempts to make sense of the world. The impulse behind science and religion is the same. It's the idea that the world must make sense, and it's an attempt to find some coherent, rational explanation for things. And that's what religion is about. It's saying that there must be an answer, and there must be an ultimate rational explanation of everything, which we call God.
Yeah. Well, that is a wonderful thought to leave off with here. You've provided a great many insights about the connection between quantum mechanics and the mind and God, and as well as some of your own personal insights. And so, Professor Barr, I really want to thank you for being on Research on Religion. It's been a delight.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.